New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org.
I'm here with Dr. Eric Mazel, author of Life Purpose Bootcamp, the 8-week breakthrough plan for creating a meaningful life. Eric, we were speaking just before the break about the movement to and fro between attachment and detachment, the way in which both of these actually play an integral role in any artistic or creative endeavor. So attachment, that is being deeply absorbed in or attached to the particular creative endeavor one is involved in, whatever it may look like, usually, if not always, must involve what we call passion. Could you speak to the notion of passion and also how you encourage that in the people you work with?
I talk a lot about meaning in my work with clients, and often that has to be retranslated into passion language and the synonyms of passion, whether it's curiosity, enthusiasm. There are all sorts of words in the family of passion that are very important. And it is in fact the case, I do believe, that creative effort comes out of a place of love. That doesn't mean that the creative person is a loving person necessarily. We know that there are monstrous creative folks who are not necessarily loving in the rest of their lives. But I think the creative act does come from that place of love. We are in a dispassionate society that doesn't do a wonderful job of encouraging passion. We're told to draw within the lines. We're told not to show displays of affection. We're told many things that don't encourage passion. So the flame of passion tends to flicker out in the lives of most people. And that natural passion that they experienced at 5 or 6 or 7 or 8, they no longer experience at 30. Life has worn them down. So we have to dream up ways to rekindle that passion. One of the best ways, and we've talked about this already a couple of times in different contexts, is to mentally and emotionally return to being 5, 6, and 7, reminding yourself how much you loved reading in the corner or being in that darkened theater, watching a movie, or watching the Nutcracker on stage, or whatever it was. That helps an adult remind themselves of where the passion resides. But however it is that you figure out to do it, it is your job to rekindle that passion, because the work can't be done with mere interest. The work can't be done dispassionately. A, that's just not enough juice. And B, it doesn't allow you to do it over the long haul because the work is just too hard. You can't spend 2 years working on a novel just out of mere interest. The source of the energy for that work has to come from a deeper place than interest.
So you really need to ask, what is it that really lights my fire? But how do you work with that question? I mean, you know, for me, it's I get people writing that. To free write for half an hour without thinking, what really lights my fire is, what do you do with them?
I think I move it more to the meaning place. If they sort of instantly get the rekindling fire thing, and if they understand how to do that for themselves, wonderful. But if they're not getting it, I personally don't stay there. I move to the meaning place, that it's your responsibility to don the mantle of meaning maker, that you're not going to be experiencing life as meaningful or purposeful or passionate if you don't do what the existentialists say, namely, treat your life as a project and get to work on your project. So I think I start to come from the drill sergeant place rather than the loving place, because I think it impresses people that they're not going to make themselves proud by their life unless they do the things that they've always intended to do and that they know they ought to be doing. So I return to that place of value-based meaning-making as the touchstone rather than the passion place.
So, but some action or something needs to happen for that meaning to be stirred. I'm thinking of these lines by the great poet, Spanish poet Antonio Machado, who said, I thought the fire was out. I stirred the ashes. I burnt my fingers. I love that.
Yes,
but stirring the ashes is what you're speaking to.
And I say it slightly differently. It's the same idea. I often use the Tchaikovsky quote, which is, I'm inspired every fifth day, but I only get that fifth day if I show up the other four. So I keep returning it to ceremony, regularity, routine, and practice. I keep returning it to practice. Then maybe you won't be inspired today. Maybe there's no flame today. You still have to be there.
Yes, you do still have to be there. You know, Chuck Close, the artist, said, you know, inspiration is for amateurs. The rest of us just get to work.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we're saying exactly the same thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And for me, process is a very important word. I sort of stand behind that word in my own being and with clients. And process means many sorts of things, including the reality of making mistakes and messes, but also the reality that only a percentage of your work is going to turn out well. Folks do not want to hear that, but that's the truth about process. How many of Bob Dylan's 463 trillion songs are wonderful? 13, 19, 24. Pundits who claim to know will say that Beethoven's first, third, fifth, seventh, and ninth symphonies are better than his second, fourth, sixth, and eighth. And I don't know if that's true, but what I know is you can't do nine without eight. You can't do eight without seven. You can't skip the things that don't work. And that's what most would-be creative people want to do. They want to skip the things that aren't going to work. And you can't skip those things. You have to spend the 2 years on that novel, even if it never comes alive. And no one wants to hear that, but that's the reality of process. An excellent example of what I mean here is the fellow who wrote Memoir of a Geisha. He wrote that book first in the third person. The geisha does this, the geisha does that. Spent some years writing it. When it was done, he read it to himself, and he realized it was stone cold dead. There was nothing there of interest. Most creative folks will call themselves a bad name at that point. They'll say, I'm an idiot for having spent these 2 years on this project. He did something dramatically wonderful. He said, now let me try it in the first person. I'm going to invest more years in this project because I still believe in it. I still have a passion for it. I just didn't make it work the first time.
This is wonderful what you're pointing to here, because, of course, for all of us, it's so tempting to give up when we think something's really not working. But your emphasis on process here is really crucial, because the process is leading us where we do not yet know. So, And can't know until we're there. And so the writer of the novel you just mentioned, Memoirs of a Geisha, I think, had no idea that this needed to be in the first person when he started in the third. But he had to run the whole course of that.
Yes.
In order to get there, you know.
I just want to add one thing, and that is when we say he didn't know or when we say we don't know, I think it's a little more complicated than that, because I think we get tingles down the spine. I think we get glimmers of the thing not working. And then there's always the question, should I abandon this because I know it's not working, or should I persist for years to make it work? And there can't be a principle there. The principle can't be always abandon or always stick it out.
Mm-hmm.
You have to feel it through in each situation, because sometimes there is no reason to throw more good words after bad. Maybe this is a project to put aside after 22,000 words or what have you. My headline, though, is, although there's no principle, my headline is, err on the side of completing things. If you have to make a guess, an intuition in a given moment, whether to finish a thing or not to finish a thing, finish it. Because you learn so much by finishing things. And you also then learn by putting it out into the marketplace, putting it out into the world. We never get a complete loop on a project until we've put it out into the world and gotten what Virginia Woolf called an echo. till we get something back from the world that helps us understand what we've wrought.
And you mentioned there that the kind of intuition, the sense that one has of whether to pour more words into this or not, is actually a bodily knowing. So this is not a thought we're speaking of here, I should end this, I should not end this, but a visceral sense, really, that if we listen to it, and that's the whole key, because in my case, certainly, I've sometimes and quite often not listened and had to go a long way.
And we want to override the feeling, too, because we don't want to give up.
Exactly.
We want to get it done, so we override the feeling. And I, like you, I've done whole books that ought to have been stopped at the 22,000-word mark because I just didn't want to give up. I didn't want to give in to the fact that it wasn't working.
I just need to, you know, put it out there that actually mistakes have led to the discovery of so many things in our world. I mean, DNA, penicillin, aspirin, x-rays, Teflon, Velcro, nylon, cornflakes, Coca-Cola, chocolate chip cookies were discovered by mistake. So really, we need to allow ourselves, don't we?
There's probably nothing else that connects that list except that they arose through a mistake.
Completely. Absolutely. Yes. Yes. But that involves a certain degree of humility too, don't you think? And I think that is also fundamental to the creative process.
It's an interesting whether it's humility or it's actually one face of a certain kind of healthy narcissism. Because the word narcissism has no particular meaning without an adjective in front of it. There's unhealthy narcissism where we're just arrogant and grandiose, and then there's the healthy narcissism that developmental psychologists say all children should acquire, that strong sense of self, strong sense of instrumentality. And so in a way, I think it's in a way a healthy narcissism to say, eh, this didn't work, but I'm so well put together, I'm so good at what I do, that the next thing will work. And it's most people who have major successes, as you say, have had major failures, and they just don't take them seriously.
And personally,
they don't take it in. Yeah, they maybe drink too much for a while, or they have several bad days, or it's not like they don't have a reaction to the failure. We all have reaction to failures, but they get back up on the horse quickly, and they're really back up there. They're not tented. They're not riding side saddle, if that's the right equestrian metaphor. They're really on the horse again fully. And I think that's actually a feature of a certain kind of healthy narcissism.
That's a really great point. I really appreciate that. Yes. And it actually brings up the whole notion of confidence, being willing to stand by what one is doing, you know, and unless and until it becomes clear that another way is necessary. But yes, that is a form of healthy healthy ego structure, really.
That's right. And many of my clients have trouble feeling confident in doing the work, but also feeling confident in putting the work out into the world. So confidence is needed in both regards.
I'm here with Dr. Eric Mizell, author of Life Purpose Bootcamp, the 8-week breakthrough plan for creating a meaningful life. I'm Roger Houston, and you're listening to New Dimensions. I'm Roger Houston, and I'm here with Eric Mizell, speaking on theme of creativity. And Eric, something we haven't spoken of, a word we haven't, I don't think, even mentioned, is the word originality. Can people really be original?
You know, it's not a word that I think about much, and it's not a word that comes up much in my conversations with clients. I think if it were to come up, I would consider it a mental trap kind of word. I would advise a client that that's probably not a word that serves them to be thinking, and that it sets the bar in a funny place because, as we said before, creativity has multiple definitions, one of which is innovation. But innovation is more a thing for the business world than for the creative person. Innovation, originality, it's not what the creative person is after, I don't think. I think the creative person is after having a spot in a lineage, being part of a tradition. And that's different from innovating or being original. It's also the case that if you're in that tradition, you naturally want to move the tradition forward. You want to, so to speak, do the next right thing in that tradition or the next interesting thing in that tradition. So I think that is where originality and innovation arises in a person's being. But I think I would still get them off that word and return them to showing up and doing the work.
I really love what you say about being part of a lineage, because all of us are actually part of a lineage, whether we know it or not. And the lineage is the human race and civilization. And we also live in a matrix of this particular time. And I think this is why, you know, the same idea can pop up in different places around the same time, because we live in a collective sea of ideas and inspirations, if you like. So often something can feel as if I've thought it for the first time. But then, of course, I realize that
some pre-Socratic.
Yes.
You thought it for.
That's right. You know, 2,500 years ago. And that that not only that, it was born out of this particular time. And, you know, I was thinking, for example, Gutenberg, as we know, created or invented the printing press, but not out of thin air. Because all the ingredients for the printing press had actually been in existence for centuries. He had the insight to put the ingredients together. You know, the screw press was traditionally used for pressing oil. He turned it to another thing. So was he really original? Well, what he did is put all these different parts together in a brilliant new way. And I think that's what we do.
And often, a creative person, especially scientists, are stuck because the super integration that they want to do just isn't possible. Einstein can't know string theory before there's string theory. He can know a lot of things, and he can come up with E equals MC squared, but he can't know what's only known 50 years hence. So scientists often get stuck in a corner of a field because it's not possible for them to do the huge super integrating work that they've been hoping to do. So that's one of the poignancies of the creative enterprise, is that sometimes we can't manage to pull together the disparate things that we wish we could pull together because it's just not available to us yet. That's another place where we have to look at a project and say to ourselves, golly, it was wonderful of me to try, but I'm not going to succeed here.
You've touched, I think, on something important here about the whole notion or nature of creativity and the imagination. When you speak of string theory and Einstein not even being able to speak of that because it's in the future, and yet I think what creativity does, it opens us up to the future because it opens us up to potentiality. Potentiality, that which has not yet been manifest. And to be open to what is potential, we need receptivity. And you spoke of this earlier, the importance of stillness, of silence, of being receptive. And I'd like us to dwell on this for a few moments, this last segment of our talk here, because I think this is so important.
Let me translate it a little bit into my language. creative people understand that they need imagination in order to get their work done. But what is imagination? Well, I think a fruitful way to think of it is what's called in the thinking sciences, divergent thinking. That is the idea that you can think of a salmon over here and a skyscraper over here and put them together and end up with a salmon-shaped skyscraper. Well, that kind of thinking is not much lauded in common society. It's not much asked of you to put a salmon and a skyscraper together. You're more to keep the skyscraper separate from the salmon. So that means you have to fight against your cultural baggage, your whole history of drawing inside the lines in order to be imaginative. And I think, to piggyback on what you're saying, I think it requires a certain permission, a certain opening, a certain understanding that there's a task here to pull things from different places together, that that's a task that we're not going to undertake unless we feel free enough to take that risk.
Yes, and perhaps even something more than just adding the pieces together. You know, in Wordsworth's time in the early 1800s, the notion of associative thinking, which is what you're speaking of, was the common ground then. I mean, people called imagination and creativity the capacity to draw different disparate elements together. But Wordsworth thought differently. He thought that actually, no, there's something in the human being that can create something more than simply the sum of parts. It's more than the sum of its parts. A poem by Wordsworth has something that in some way has not really quite been put together before. And that capacity, again, I suppose, touches on our original discussion at the beginning there on genius, on that dimension of our humanness, which is below the conscious mind. Something, imagination itself, really, as being a dimension of experience that opens us to possibilities beyond rational thinking.
I think all creative people have had that experience.
Yes.
Of doing really good work, having something new arise. I think that's also a visceral tingle down the spine kind of experience where we like applaud ourselves. We go, wow, that was a really good paragraph, or that was a really good whatever. Wherever that came from, that was really good. I don't think you can ask for that. I think we're both saying the same thing. You can't beg for it. I think the French have a line about one great line of each poem comes from the heavens. It's not really the poet's line. It comes from somewhere. Well, it comes from the poet, but you can't just ask for it. You can't beg for it. So it's why I keep returning my clients to the task of showing up, the activity of showing up, doing the work, understanding the challenges that they're going to face doing the work, not giving up, believing that what they're doing matters, having all kinds of affirmations for themselves to keep them going through difficulties, including difficulties with the marketplace. I completely agree that there is such a thing as brilliant work, original work, new things under the sun. We just can't ask for them.
We can't ask them. We can make ourselves available to them. And the very first way is, I think, what you've been emphasizing all the way through here is show up. Hemingway called the white page the white bull. The white page for a writer is frightening because it's empty and we have no idea what's going to come out of us onto it. And it's the same with a painter with the canvas. But we do have to sit down there for a period of time and face that white bull. So there is the work. There is the work of sitting down and doing it. But I think there's also that other kind of capacity, which is Keats, the poet, called it negative capability, you know, which is to allow ourselves to be in an almost dreamlike state where we're receptive to what we do not yet know. Lounging on our sofa for half an hour And for me, you know, most of my books have come when I've been out walking. The idea for the book has come when I've been walking, not thinking about books. So I think there really is a place here.
For Mozart, it was carriage rides.
Yes, absolutely.
I'd like to piggyback on that, because when I was talking earlier about a morning creativity practice being so vital for my clients, and I think for creative folks, one of the things you're saying connects to that very clearly. I think there are three important reasons why a morning practice is so important. A, the regularity and routine of it is great, and you'll get a lot of work done. B, you'll have the experience of having made some meaning on that day, and the rest of the day can be half meaningless, and you won't get depressed. It's like you're building up meaning capital by turning to your real work first thing. But the C connects to what you were saying, and that is by turning to your creative work first thing, you get to make use of your sleep thinking. That is, you get to make use of what your brain's been working on all night long, your dreaming brain, your thinking brain, and that's completely valuable material, which if you don't turn to your work first thing, you're not going to have access to.
What a great point that is, Eric. Yes, we've run out of time, but we really do all need to give time and space to dreaming. I've been speaking with Dr. Eric Mazel, author of Life Purpose Bootcamp, the 8-week breakthrough plan for creating a meaningful life. If you'd like to know more about the work of Dr. Mazel, you can go to his website, ericmazel.com. That's ericmazel.com. Or you can get there on the New Dimensions website. I'm Roger Houston. You've been listening to New Dimensions. This is program number 3531.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA. Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. For over 4 decades, New Dimensions has been producing weekly conversations at the leading edge. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org. Or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore New Dimensions. New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
I'm Willis Barnstone, translator of the Restored New Testament. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about my love for poetry and sacred texts.
Listen to Scream Therapy, a show about the link between punk rock and mental health, hosted by me, Jason Schurz. I've been part of the music scene for more than 30 years. I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and my whole life was thrown sideways. As part of my recovery, I've slowly returned to the music that I love. Join me and my resilient guests for no holds barred conversations right here on CJSF 90.1 FM, Simon Fraser University, Thursdays at 12:30 a.m. And until then, take care and be well.